I have a feeling that it's been getting steadily worse. Maybe because there have been more people in Derry at the end of each cycle. Maybe for some other reason. And in 1958, the cycle appears to have come to a premature end, for which we were responsible. Bill Denbrough leaned forward, his eyes suddenly bright. You're sure of that?
Sure?
Yes, Mike said. All the other cycles reached their peak around September and then ended in a big way. Life usually took on its more or less normal tenor by Christmas, Easter at the latest. In other words, there were bad years for 14 to 20 months every 27 years. But the bad year that began when your brother was killed in October of 1957 ended quite abruptly in August of 1958.
Why?
Eddie asked urgently. His breath had thinned. Bill remembered that high whistle as Eddie inhaled breath and knew that he would soon be tooting on the old lung sucker.
What did we do?
The question hung there. Mike seemed to regard it, and at last he shook his head. You'll remember, he said. In time, you'll remember.
What if we don't?
Ben asked.
Then God help us all. 9 children dead this year, Rich said. Christ.
Lisa Albrecht and Stephen Johnson in late 1984, Mike said. In February, a boy named Dennis Torrio disappeared, a high school boy. His body was found in mid-March in the Barrens, mutilated.
This was nearby.
He took a photograph from the same pocket into which he had replaced the notebook. It made its way around the table. Beverly and Eddie looked at it, puzzled. But Richie Tozier reacted violently. He dropped it as if it were hot.
Jesus! Jesus, Mike!
He looked up, his eyes wide and shocked. A moment later, he passed the picture to Bill. Bill looked at it and felt the world swim into gray tones all around him. For a moment, he was sure he would pass out. He heard a groan and knew he had made the sound. He dropped the picture.
What is it?
He heard Beverly saying. What does it mean, Bill?
It's my brother's school picture, Bill said at last. It's Georgie. The picture from his album. The one that moved. The one that winked.
They handed it around again then, while Bill sat as still as stone at the head of the table, looking out into space. It was a photograph of a photograph. The picture showed a tattered school photo propped up against a white background, smiling lips parted to exhibit two holes where new teeth had never grown.
Unless they grow in your coffin, Bill thought and shuddered.
On the margin below George's picture were the words, School Friends, 1957-58.
It was found this year? Beverly asked again.
Mike nodded and she turned to Bill.
When did you see it last, Bill?
He wet his lips, tried to speak. Nothing came out. He tried again, hearing the words echo in his head, aware of the stutter coming back, fighting it, fighting the terror.
I haven't seen that picture since 1958. That spring, the year after George died. When I tried to show it to Richie, it was gone.
There was an explosive gasping sound that made them all look around. Eddie was setting his aspirator back on the table and looking slightly embarrassed.
Eddie Kasprak blasts off, Richie cried cheerfully,
and then suddenly and eerily, the voice of the movie-tone newsreel narrator came from Rich's mouth.
Today, in Derry, a whole city turns out for asthmatics on parade, and the star of the show is Big Ed the Snothead, known all over New England as...
He stopped abruptly, and one hand moved toward his face, as if to cover his eyes. And Bill suddenly thought,
No, that's not it. Not to cover his eyes, but to push his glasses up on his nose. The glasses that aren't even there anymore. Oh, dear Christ, what's going on here?
Eddie, I'm sorry, Rich said. That was cruel. I don't know what the hell I was thinking about. He looked around at the others, bewildered. Mike Hanlon spoke into the silence.
I'd promised myself after Stephen Johnson's body was discovered that if anything else happened, if there was one more clear case, I would make the calls that I ended up not making for another 2 months. It was as if I was hypnotized by what was happening, by the consciousness of it, the deliberateness of it.
George's picture was found by a fallen log less than 10 feet from the Torrio boy's body. It wasn't hidden, quite the contrary. It was as if the killer wanted it to be found, as I'm sure the killer did.
How did you get the police photo, Mike? Ben asked. That's what it is, isn't it? Yes, that's what it is. There's a fellow in the police department who isn't averse to making a little extra money. I pay him $20 a month, all that I can afford. He's a pipeline. The body of Dawn Roy was found 4 days after the Torrio boy. McCarran Park, 13 years old, decapitated. April 23rd of this year, Adam Terrault, 16, reported missing when he didn't come home from band practice. Found the next day just off the path that runs through the green belt behind West Broadway. Also decapitated. May 6th, Frederick Cohen, 2 1/2, found in an upstairs bathroom, drowned in the toilet. "Oh, Mike," Beverly cried. "Yeah, it's bad," he said almost angrily. "Don't you think I know that?" "The police are convinced that it couldn't have been, well, some kind of accident?" Bev asked. Mike shook his head. His mother was hanging clothes in the backyard. She heard sounds of a struggle, heard her son screaming. She ran as fast as she could. As she went up the stairs, she says she heard the sound of the toilet flushing repeatedly. That, and someone laughing. She said it didn't sound human. "And she saw nothing at all?" Eddie asked. "Her son," Mike said simply. His back had been broken, his skull fractured. The glass door of the shower stall was broken. There was blood everywhere. The mother is in the Bangor Mental Health Institute now. My police department source says she's quite lost her mind. "No fucking wonder," Richie said hoarsely. "Who's got a cigarette?" Beverly gave him one. Rich lit it with hands that shook badly. The police line is that the killer came in through the front door while the Cohen boy's mother was hanging her clothes in the backyard. Then, when she ran up the back stairs, he supposedly jumped from the bathroom window into the yard she'd just left and got away clean. But the window was only one of those half-sized jobs. A kid of 7 would have to wriggle to get through it. And the drop was 25 feet to a stone flag patio. Rademacher doesn't like to talk about those things, and no one in the press, certainly no one at the news, has pressed him about them. Mike took a drink of water and then passed another picture down the line. This was not a police photograph. It was another school picture. It showed a grinning boy who was maybe 13. He was dressed in his best for the school photo and his hands were clean and folded neatly in his lap, but there was a devilish little glint in his eyes. He was black. Jeffrey Holly, Mike said. May 13th, a week after the Cohen boy was killed. Torn open. He was found in Basie Park by the canal. 9 days after that, May 22nd, a fifth grader named John Fury was found dead out on Niebolt Street. Eddie uttered a high, quavering scream. He groped for his aspirator and knocked it off the table. It rolled down to Bill, who picked it up. Eddie's face had gone a sickish yellow color. His breath whistled coldly in his throat. "Get him something to drink," Ben roared. "Somebody get him." But Eddie was shaking his head. He triggered the aspirator down his throat. His chest heaved as he tore in a gulp of air. He triggered the aspirator again and then sat down, eyes half closed, panting. "I'll be all right," he gasped. "Give me a minute. I'm with you." "Eddie, are you sure?" Beverly asked. "Maybe you ought to lie down." "I'll be all right," he repeated querulously. "It was just the shock, you know, the shock. I'd forgotten all about Niebolt Street." No one replied. No one had to. Bill thought, "You believe your capacity has been reached?" And then Mike produces another name, and yet another, like a black magician with a hat full of malign tricks, and you're knocked on your ass again. It was too much to face all at once, this outpouring of inexplicable violence, somehow directly aimed at the 6 people here, or so George's photograph seemed to suggest. "Both of John Fury's legs were gone," Mike continued softly. "But the medical examiner says that happened after he died. His heart gave out. He seems to have quite literally died of fear. He was found by the postman, who saw a hand sticking out from under the porch." "It was 29, wasn't it?" Rich said, and Bill looked at him quickly. Rich glanced back at him, nodded slightly, and then looked at Mike again. 29 Niebolt Street. "Oh, yes," Mike said in that same calm voice. "It was number 29. He drank more water. "Are you really all right, Eddie?" Eddie nodded. His breathing had eased. Rademacher made an arrest the day after Fury's body was discovered. Mike said. There was a front-page editorial in the news that same day, calling for his resignation, incidentally.
After 8 murders, Ben said, pretty radical of them, wouldn't you say?
Beverly wanted to know who had been arrested. A guy who lives in a little shack way out on Route 7, almost over the town line and into Newport, Mike said. Kind of a hermit. Burned scrap wood in his stove, roofed the place with scavenged shingles and hubcaps. Name of Harold Earl. Probably doesn't see $200 in cash money over the course of a year. Someone driving by saw him standing out in his dooryard, just looking up at the sky, on the day John Fury's body was discovered. His clothes were covered with blood.
Then maybe, Rich began hopefully.
He had 3 butchered deer in his shed, Mike said. He'd been jacking over in Haven. The blood on his clothes was deer blood. Rademacher asked him if he killed John Fury, and Earl is supposed to have said,
Yeah, I killed a lot of people. I shot most of them in the war.
He also said he'd seen things in the woods at night. Blue lights sometimes, floating just a few inches off the ground. Corpse lights, he called them. And Bigfoot. They sent him up to the Bangor Mental Health. According to the medical report, his liver's almost entirely gone. He's been drinking paint thinner.
Oh, my God, Beverly said.
And is prone to hallucinations. They've been holding on to him, and until 3 days ago, Rademacher was sticking to his idea that Earl was the most likely suspect. He had 8 guys out there, digging around his shack and looking for the missing heads, lampshades made out of human skin, God knows what.
Mike paused, head lowered, and then went on. His voice was slightly hoarse now.
I'd held off and held off. But when I saw this last one, I made the calls. I wish to God I'd made them sooner.
Let's see, Ben said abruptly.
The victim was another 5th grader, Mike said, a classmate of the Fury boy. He was found just off Kansas Street, near where Bill used to hide his bike when we were in the Barrens. His name was Jerry Bellwood. He was torn apart. What was left of him was found at the foot of a cement retaining wall that was put in along most of Kansas Street about 20 years ago to stop the soil erosion. This police photograph of the section of that wall where Bellwood was found was taken less than 30 minutes after the body was removed. Here.
He passed the picture to Rich Tozier, who looked and passed it on to Beverly. She glanced at it briefly, winced, and passed it on to Eddie, who gazed at it long and raptly before handing it on to Ben. Ben passed it to Bill with barely a glance. Printing straggled its way across the concrete retaining wall. It said, Come home, come home, come home. Bill looked up at Mike grimly. He had been bewildered and frightened. Now he felt the first stirrings of anger. He was glad. Angry was not such a great way to feel, but it was better than the shock, better than the miserable fear.
Is that written in what I think it's written in?
Yes, Mike said. Jerry Bellwood's blood. 5. Richie gets beeped. Mike had taken his photographs back. He had an idea that Bill might ask for the one of George's last school picture, but Bill did not. He put them in his inside jacket pocket, and when they were out of sight, all of them, Mike included, felt a sense of relief.
9 children, Beverly was saying softly. I can't believe it. I mean, I can believe it, but I can't believe it. 9 kids and nothing? Nothing at all?
It's not quite like that, Mike said. People are angry. People are scared. Or so it seems. It's really impossible to tell which ones really feel that way and which ones are faking.
Faking?
Beverly, do you remember when we were kids, the man who just folded his newspaper and went inside his house while you were screaming at him for help? For a moment, something seemed to jump in her eyes, and she looked both terrified and aware. Then she only looked puzzled.
No. When was that, Mike?
Never mind. It will come to you in time. All I can say now is that everything looks the way it should in Derry. Faced with such a grisly string of murders, people are doing all the things you'd expect them to do, and most of them are the same things that went on while kids were disappearing and getting murdered back in 58. The Save Our Children Committee is meeting again, only this time at Derry Elementary School instead of Derry High. There are 16 detectives from the State Attorney General's office in town, and a contingent of FBI agents as well, I don't know how many, and although Rademacher talks big, I don't think he does either. The curfew's back in effect. Oh, yes, the curfew. Ben was rubbing the side of his neck slowly and deliberately. That did wonders back in 58. I remember that much. And there are mothers' walker groups to make sure that every child who goes to school, grades K through 8, is chaperoned home. The news has gotten over 2,000 letters demanding a solution in the last 3 weeks alone. And, of course, the out-migration has begun again. I sometimes think that's the only way to really tell who's sincere about wanting it stopped and who isn't. The really sincere ones get scared and leave. People really are leaving? Richie asked. It happens each time the cycle cranks up again. It's impossible to tell just how many go, because the cycle hasn't fallen squarely in a census year since 1850 or so. But it's a fairish number. They run like kids who just found out the house was haunted for real after all.
Come home, come home, come home, Beverly said softly.
When she looked up from her hands, it was Bill she looked at, not Mike.
It wanted us to come back. Why?
It may want us all back, Mike said a little cryptically. Sure, it may. It may want revenge. After all, we balked it once before.
Revenge, or just to set things back in order, Bill said.
Mike nodded.
Things are out of order in your own lives, too, you know. None of you left Derry untouched, without its mark on you. All of you forgot what happened here, and your memories of that summer are still only fragmentary. And then there's the passing curious fact that you're all rich.
Oh, come on now, Richie said. That's hardly...
be soft, Mike said, holding his hand up and smiling faintly. I'm not accusing you of anything, just trying to get the facts out on the table.
You are rich by the standards of a small-town librarian who makes just under 11 grand a year after taxes, okay? Rich shrugged the shoulders of his expensive suit uncomfortably. Ben appeared deeply absorbed in tearing small strips from the edge of his napkin. No one was looking directly at Mike except Bill.
None of you are in the H.L. Hunt class, certainly, Mike said, but you are all well-to-do even by the standards of the American upper middle class. We're all friends here, so fess up. If there's one of you who declared less than $90,000 on his or her 1984 tax return, raise your hand.
They glanced around at each other almost furtively, embarrassed, as Americans always seem to be, by the raw fact of their own success. As if cash were hard-cooked eggs and affluence the farts that inevitably follow an overdose of same. Bill felt hot blood in his cheeks and was helpless to stop its rise. He had been paid $10,000 more than the sum Mike had mentioned just for doing the first draft of the Attic Room screenplay. He had been promised an additional $20,000 each for two rewrites if needed. Then there were royalties and the hefty advance on a two-book contract just signed. How much had he declared on his 84 tax return?
Just about $800,000, right?
Enough, anyway, to seem almost monstrous in light of Mike Hanlon's stated income of just under $11,000 a year.
So that's how much they pay you to keep the lighthouse, Mike, old kid, Bill thought. Jesus Christ, somewhere along the line you should have asked for a raise.
Mike said, Bill Denbro. A successful novelist in a society where there are only a few novelists and fewer still lucky enough to be making a living from the craft. Beverly Rogan, who's in the rag trade, a field to which more are called but even fewer chosen. She is, in fact, the most sought-after designer in the middle third of the country right now.
Oh, it's not me, Beverly said.
She uttered a nervous little laugh and lit a fresh cigarette from the smoldering stub of the old one.
It's Tom. Tom's the one. Without him, I'd still be relining skirts and sewing up hems. I don't have any business sense at all. Even Tom says so. It's just, you know, Tom. And luck.
She took a single deep drag from her cigarette and then snuffed it.
Methinks the lady doth protest too much, Richie said slyly.
She turned quickly in her seat and gave him a hard look, her color high.
Just what's that supposed to mean, Richie Tozier?
Don't hit me, Miss Scarlet,
Richie cried in a high, trembling, pickaninny voice. And in that moment, Bill could see with an eerie clarity the boy he had known. He was not just a superseded presence lurking under Rich Tozier's grown-up exterior, but a creature almost more real than the man himself.
Don't hit me. Let me bring you another mint julep, Miss Scarlet. Yous gon' drink hit out on de poach where it's be a little bit cooler? Don't whoop dis year, boy.
You're impossible, Richie, Beverly said coldly. You ought to grow up.
Richie looked at her, his grin fading slowly into uncertainty. Until I came back here, he said, I thought I had.
Rich, you may just be the most successful disc jockey in the United States, Mike said. You've certainly got L.A. in the palm of your hand. On top of that, there are two syndicated programs, one of them a straight top 40 countdown show, the other one something called the Freaky 40.
You better watch out, fool, Richie said in a gruff Mr. T voice, but he was blushing. I'll make your front and back change places. I'll give you brain surgery with my fist. I'll...
Eddie, Mike went on, ignoring Richie, you've got a healthy limousine service in a city where you just about have to elbow long black cars out of your way when you cross the street. Two limo companies a week go smash in the Big Apple, but you're doing fine.
Ben, you're probably the most successful young architect in the world.
Ben opened his mouth, probably to protest, and then closed it again abruptly. Mike smiled at them, spread his hands.
I don't want to embarrass anyone, but I do want all the cards on the table. There are people who succeed young, and there are people who succeed in highly specialized jobs. If there weren't people who bucked the odds successfully, I guess everybody would give up. If it was just one or two of you, we could pass it off as coincidence. But it's not just one or two. It's all of you. And that includes Dan Uris, who is the most successful young accountant in Atlanta, which means in the whole South. My conclusion is that your success stems from what happened here 27 years ago.
If you had all been exposed to asbestos at that time and had all developed lung cancer by now, the correlative would be no less clear or persuasive. Do any of you want to dispute it? He looked at them. No one answered.
All except you, Bill said. What happened to you, Mikey?
Isn't it obvious? He grinned. I stayed here.
You kept the lighthouse, Ben said.
Bill jerked around and looked at him, startled, but Ben was staring hard at Mike and didn't see.
That doesn't make me feel so good, Mike. In fact, it makes me feel sort of like a bug turd.
Amen, Beverly said. Mike shook his head patiently.
You have nothing to feel guilty about, any of you.
Do you think it was my choice to stay here any more than it was your choice, any of you, to leave?
Hell, we were kids. For one reason or another, your parents moved away, and you guys were part of the baggage they took along. My parents stayed.
And was it really their decision, any of them?
I don't think so.
How was it decided who would go and who would stay? Was it luck, fate, it, some other?
I don't know, but it wasn't us guys, so quit it.
You're not bitter? Eddie asked timidly.
I've been too busy to be bitter, Mike said. I've spent a long time watching and waiting. I was watching and waiting even before I knew it, I think. But for the last 5 years or so, I've been on what you might call red alert. Since the turn of the year, I've been keeping a journal. And when a man writes, he thinks harder, or maybe just more specifically. And one of the things I've spent time writing and thinking about is the nature of it. It changes. We know that. I think it also manipulates and leaves its marks on people just by the nature of what it is. The way you can smell a skunk on you even after a long bath if it lets go its bag of scent too near you. The way a grasshopper will spit bug juice into your palm if you catch it in your hand.
Mike slowly unbuttoned his shirt and spread it wide. They could all see the pinkish scrawls of scar across the smooth brown skin of his chest between the nipples.
The way claws leave scars, he said.
The werewolf, Richie almost moaned. Oh, Christ, Big Bill, the werewolf, when we went back to Niebolt Street.
What?
Bill asked. He sounded like a man called out of a dream.
What, Richie? Don't you remember?
No, do you?
I almost do.
Looking both confused and scared, Richie subsided.
Are you saying this thing isn't evil? Eddie asked Mike abruptly.
He was staring at the scars as if hypnotized.
That it's just some part of the natural order?
It's no part of a natural order we understand or condone, Mike said, rebuttoning his shirt. And I see no reason to operate on any other basis than the one we do understand.
That it kills children, and that's wrong. Bill understood that before any of us. Do you remember, Bill?
I remember that I wanted to kill it, Bill said, and for the first time, and ever after, he heard the pronoun gain proper noun status in his own voice. But I didn't have much of a world view on the subject, if you see what I mean. I just wanted to kill it because it killed George. And do you still? Bill considered this carefully. He looked down at his spread hands on the table and remembered George and his yellow slicker, his hood up, the paper boat with its thin glaze of paraffin in one hand. He looked up at Mike. More than ever, he said. Mike nodded as if this were exactly what he had expected. It left its mark on us. It worked its will on us, just as it has worked its will on this whole town, day in and day out, even during those long periods when it is asleep or hibernating, or whatever it does between its more lively periods. Mike raised one finger. But if it worked its will on us, at some point, in some way, we also worked our will on it. We stopped it before it was done. I know we did. Did we weaken it, hurt it? Did we, in fact, almost kill it? I think we did. I think we came so close to killing it that we went away thinking we had. But you don't remember that part either, do you? Ben asked. No. I can remember everything up until August 15th, 1958, with almost perfect clarity. But from then until September 4th or so, when school was called in again, everything is a total blank. It isn't murky or hazy. It is just completely gone. With one exception. I seem to remember Bill screaming about something called the deadlights. Bill's arm jerked convulsively. It struck one of his empty beer bottles, and the bottle shattered on the floor like a bomb. Did you cut yourself? Beverly asked. She had half risen. No, he said. His voice was harsh and dry. His arms had broken out in goose flesh. It seemed that his skull had somehow grown. He could feel the deadlights, it pressing out against the stretched skin of his face in steady, numbing throbs. I'll pick up the... No, just sit down. He wanted to look at her and couldn't. He couldn't take his eyes off Mike. Do you remember the deadlights, Bill? Mike asked softly. No, he said. His mouth felt the way it did when the dentist got a little too enthusiastic with the Novocaine. You will. I hope to God I don't. You will anyway, Mike said. But for now, no, not me either. Do any of you? One by one, they shook their heads. But we did something, Mike said quietly. At some point, we were able to exercise some sort of group will. At some point, we achieved some special understanding, whether conscious or unconscious. He stirred restlessly. God, I wish Stan was here. I have a feeling that Stan, with his ordered mind, might have had some idea. Maybe he did, Beverly said. Maybe that's why he killed himself. Maybe he understood that if there was magic, it wouldn't work for grown-ups. I think it could, though, Mike said, because there's one other thing we six have in common. I wonder if any of you have realized what it is. It was Bill's turn to open his mouth and then shut it again. Go on, Mike said. You know what it is. I can see it on your face. I'm not sure I know, Bill replied, but I think, well, we're all childless. Is that it? There was a moment of shocked silence. Yeah, Mike said. That's it. Jesus Christ Almighty, Eddie spoke up indignantly. What in the world does that have to do with the price of beans in Peru? What gave you the idea that everyone in the world has to have kids? That's nuts. Do you and your wife have children? Mike asked. If you've been keeping track of us the way you said, then you know goddamn well we don't. But I still say it doesn't mean a damn thing. Have you tried to have children? We don't use birth control, if that's what you mean, Eddie spoke with an oddly moving dignity, but his cheeks were flushed. It just so happens that my wife is a little... Oh, hell, she's a lot overweight. We went to see a doctor, and she told us my wife might never have kids if she didn't lose some weight. Does that make us criminals? Take it easy, Eds, Richie soothed and leaned toward him. Don't call me Eds, and don't you dare pinch my cheek, he cried, rounding on Richie. You know I hate that. I always hated it. Richie recoiled, blinking. Beverly? Mike asked. What about you and Tom? No children, she said. Also, no birth control. Tom wants kids, and so do I, of course, she added hastily, glancing around at them quickly. Bill thought her eyes seemed overbright, almost the eyes of an actress giving a good performance. It just hasn't happened yet. Have you had those tests? Ben asked her.
Oh, yes, of course, she said, and uttered a light laugh that was almost a titter. And in one of those leaps of comprehension that sometimes come to people who are gifted with both curiosity and insight, Bill suddenly understood a great deal about Beverly and her husband Tom, alias the greatest man in the world. Beverly had gone to have fertility tests. His guess was that the greatest man in the world had refused to entertain even for a moment the notion that there might be something wrong with the sperm being manufactured in the sacred sex.
What about you and your wife, Big Bill? Rich asked.
Been trying?
They all looked at him curiously because his wife was someone they knew. Audra was by no means the best known or the best loved actress in the world, but she was certainly part of the celebrity coinage that had somehow replaced talent as a medium of exchange in the latter half of the 20th century. There had been a picture of her in People magazine when she cut her hair short, and during a particularly boring stretch in New York. The play she had been planning to do off-Broadway fell through. She had done a week-long stint on Hollywood Squares over her agent's strenuous objections. She was a stranger whose lovely face was known to them. He thought Beverly looked particularly curious.
We've been trying off and on for the last 6 years, Bill said. For the last 8 months or so, it's been off because of the movie we were doing. Attic Room, it's called. You know, we run a little entertainment, Cindy, every day from 5:15 in the afternoon until 5:30, Richie said. Seeing Stars, it's called. They had a feature on that damned movie just last week. Husband and wife working happily together kind of thing. They said both of your names, and I never made the connection. Funny, isn't it?
Very, Bill said.
Anyway, Audra said it would be just our luck if she caught pregnant while we were in pre-production and she had to do 10 weeks of strenuous acting and being morning sick at the same time. But we want kids, yes, and we've tried quite hard.
Had fertility tests? Ben asked.
4 years ago in New York, the doctors discovered a very small benign tumor in Audra's womb, and they said it was a lucky thing because, although it wouldn't have prevented her from getting pregnant, it might have caused a tubal pregnancy. She and I are both fertile, though.
Eddie repeated stubbornly, It doesn't prove a goddamn thing.
Suggestive, though, Ben murmured.
No little accidents on your front, Ben? Bill asked. He was shocked and amused to find that his mouth had very nearly called Ben Haystack instead.
I've never been married, I've always been careful, and there have been no paternity suits, Ben said. Beyond that, I don't think there's any real way of telling.
You want to hear a funny story? Richie asked. He was smiling, but there was no smile in his eyes.
Sure, Bill said. You were always good at the funny stuff, Richie.
Your face in me own buttocks, boyo,
Richie said in the Irish cop's voice. It was a great Irish cop's voice.
You've improved out of all measure, Richie, Bill thought. As a kid, you couldn't do an Irish cop no matter how you busted your brains. Except once. Or twice.
When?
The deadlights.
Was that? Your face in me own buttocks. Just keep remembering that comparison, me foine bucko.
Ben Hanscom suddenly held his nose and cried in a high, quavering, boyish voice,
Beep, beep, Richie, beep, 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 beep.
After a moment, laughing, Eddie held his own nose and joined in. Beverly did the same.
All right, Richie cried, laughing himself. All right, I give up, Christ's sake.
Oh, man, Eddie said.
He collapsed back in his chair, laughing so hard he was almost crying.
We got you that time, trash mouth. Way to go, Ben.
Ben was smiling, but he looked a little bewildered.
Beep, beep,
Bev said and giggled.
I forgot all about that. We always used to beep you, Richie.
You guys never appreciated true talent, that's all, Richie said comfortably.
As in the old days, you could knock him off balance, but he was like one of those inflatable Joe Palooka dolls with sand in the base. He floated upright again almost at once.
That was one of your little contributions to the Losers Club, wasn't it, Haystack?
Yeah, I guess it was.
What a man,
Richie said in a trembling, awestruck voice, and then began to salaam over the table, nearly sticking his nose in his teacup each time he went down.
What a man! Oh, chillin', what a man!
Beep, beep, Richie,
Ben said solemnly, and then exploded laughter in a hearty baritone utterly unlike his wavering childhood voice.
You're the same old roadrunner.
You guys want to hear this story or not? Richie asked.
I mean, no big deal one way or the other. Beep away if you want to. I can take abuse.
I mean, you're looking at a man who once did an interview with Ozzy Osbourne.
Tell it,
Bill said. He glanced over at Mike and saw that Mike looked happier, or more at rest, since the luncheon had begun.
Was it because he saw the almost unconscious knitting together that was happening, the sort of easy falling back into old roles that almost never happened when old chums got together?
Bill thought so, and he thought, if there are certain preconditions for the belief in magic that makes it possible to use the magic, then maybe those preconditions will inevitably arrange themselves.
It was not a very comforting thought. It made him feel like a man strapped to the nose cone of a guided missile.
Beep, beep, indeed.
Well, Richie was saying, I could make this long and sad, or I could give you the Blondie and Dagwood comic strip version, but I'll settle for something in the middle. The year after I moved out to California, I met a girl, and we felt pretty hard for each other, started living together. She was on the pill at first, but it made her feel sick almost all the time. She talked about getting an IUD, but I wasn't too crazy about that. The first stories about how they might not be completely safe were just starting to come out in the papers. We had talked a lot about kids, and had pretty well decided we didn't want them even if we decided to legalize the relationship. Irresponsible to bring kids into such a shitty, dangerous, overpopulated world. And blah, 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 babble, babble, babble. Let's go out and put a bomb in the men's room of the Bank of America, and then come on back to the crash pad and smoke some dope and talk about the difference between Maoism and Trotskyism, if you see what I mean. Or maybe I'm being too hard on both of us. Shit, we were young and reasonably idealistic. The upshot was that I got my wires cut, as the Beverly Hills crowd puts it with their unfailing vulgar chic. The operation went with no problem, and I had no adverse after effects. There can be, you know. I had a friend whose balls swelled up to roughly the size of the tires of a 1959 Cadillac. I was going to give him a pair of suspenders and a couple of barrels for his birthday, sort of a designer truss, but they went down before then. All put with your customary tact and dignity, Bill remarked, and Beverly began to laugh again. Richie offered a large, sincere smile. Thank you, Bill, for those words of support. The word fuck was used 206 times in your last book. I counted.
Beep, beep, trash mouth, Bill said solemnly, and they all laughed.
Bill found it nearly impossible to believe they had been talking about dead children less than 10 minutes ago.
Press onward, Richie, Ben said. The hour groweth late.
Sandy and I lived together for 2.5 years, Richie went on. Came really close to getting married twice. As things turned out, I guess we saved ourselves a lot of heartache and all that community property bullshit by keeping it simple. She got an offer to join a corporate law firm in Washington around the same time I got an offer to come to KLAD as a weekend jock. Not much, but a foot in the door. She told me it was her big chance, and I had to be the most insensitive male chauvinist oinker in the United States to be dragging my feet, and furthermore, she'd had it with California anyway. I told her I also had a chance. So we thrashed it out, and we trashed each other out, and at the end of all the thrashing and trashing, Sandy went. About a year after that, I decided to try and get the vasectomy reversed. No real reason for it, and I knew from the stuff I'd read that the chances were pretty spotty, but I thought, what the hell?
You were seeing someone steadily then? Bill asked.
No, that's the funny part of it, Richie said, frowning. I just woke up one day with this, I don't know, this hobby horse about getting it reversed.
You must have been nuts, Eddie said. General anesthetic instead of a local? Surgery? Maybe a week in the hospital afterward?
Yeah, the doctor told me all of that stuff, Richie replied. And I told him I wanted to go ahead anyway. I don't know why. The doc asked me if I understood the aftermath of the operation was sure to be painful, while the result was only going to be a coin toss at best. I said I did. He said okay, and I asked him when. My attitude being the sooner the better, you know. So he says, hold your horses, son, hold your horses. The first step is to get a sperm sample just to make sure the reversal operation is necessary. I said, come on, I had the exam after the vasectomy. It worked. He told me that sometimes the vasa reconnected spontaneously. Yo, mama, I says, nobody ever told me that. He said the chances were very small, infinitesimal, really. But because the operation was so serious, we ought to check it out. So I popped into the men's room with the Fredericks of Hollywood catalog and jerked off into a Dixie cup.
Beep, beep, Richie, Beverly said.
Yeah, you're right, Richie said.
The part about the Fredericks catalog is a lie. You never find anything that good in a doctor's office. Anyway, the doc called me 3 days later and asked me which I wanted first, the good news or the bad news. Give me the good news first, I said. The good news is the operation won't be necessary, he said. The bad news is that anybody you've been to bed with over the last 2 or 3 years could hit you with a paternity suit pretty much at will.
Are you saying what I think you're saying? I asked him.
I'm telling you that you aren't shooting blanks and haven't been for quite a while now, he said. Millions of little wigglies in your sperm sample. Your days of going gaily in bareback with no questions asked have temporarily come to an end, Richard. I thanked him and hung up. Then I called Sandy in Washington.
Rich, she says to me.
And Richie's voice suddenly became the voice of this girl, Sandy, whom none of them had ever met. It was not an imitation or even a likeness, exactly. It was more like an auditory painting.
It's great to hear from you. I got married.
Yeah, that's great, I said. You should have let me know. I would have sent you a blender.
She goes, same old Richie, always full of gags.
So I said, sure, same old Richie, always full of gags. By the way, Sandy, you didn't happen to have a kid or anything after you left L.A., did you? Or maybe an unscheduled D&C or something?
That gag isn't so funny, Rich, she said,
and I had a brainwave that she was getting ready to hang up on me, so I told her what happened. She started laughing, only this time it was real hard. She was laughing the way I always used to laugh with you guys, like somebody had told her the world's biggest belly buster. So when she finally starts slowing down, I ask her what in God's name is funny.
It's just so wonderful, she said. This time the joke's on you. After all these years, the joke is finally on Records Tozier. How many bastards have you sired since I came east, Rich?
I take it that means you still haven't experienced the joys of motherhood, I ask her.
I'm due in July, she says. Were there any more questions?
Yeah, I go. When did you change your mind about the immorality of bringing children into such a shitty world?
When I finally met a man who wasn't a shit, she answers and hangs up.
Bill began to laugh. He laughed until tears rolled down his cheeks. Yeah, Richie said. I think she cut it off quick so she'd really get the last word. But she could have hung on the line all day. I know when I've been aced. I went back to the doctor a week later and asked him if he could be a little clearer on the odds against that sort of spontaneous regeneration. He said he'd talked with some of his colleagues about the matter. It turned out that in the 3-year period, 1980 through 82, the California branch of the AMA logged 23 reports of spontaneous regeneration. 6 of those turned out to be simply botched operations. 6 others were either hoaxes or cons. Guys looking to take a bite out of some doctor's bank account. So, 11 real ones in 3 years.